This is an RNZ podcast.
Nau mai, whakarongo mai ki te Aotai Whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
Great to have your company. I'm Duncan Smith.
Today we're meeting a farmer in North Canterbury. He's also a YouTuber, and we'll be checking in with him every month to give you a regular taste of his life on the land.
We're in the classroom with children who are also finding out about farming online. They connect regularly with a farmer via a live stream video link.
Later on, I'm on Mahia Peninsula on the East Coast with writer and historian Mere Whaanga. We're dipping into the fascinating story of her family farm where 21 generations have lived and thrived. Ancient trees grown for their perfume are just one of the secrets they've uncovered there.
But first, to our look at conditions on the land. Sluggish grass growth in Northland means bulls aren't putting on as much weight as farmers would like, and they're still out on a 40-day rotation on paddocks. Usually at this time, they've been moved to a 22-day cycle and are putting on about a couple of kilos each day. The high cost of nitrogen fertiliser has put some off using it this year, adding to slow grass growth. Strawberry growers further south in Matakana are also hoping for warmth and sun. Strawberries are not ripening as quickly as usual. The rain and chilly mornings mixed with a few overcast days has resulted in lower volumes. However, the quality of fruit going to the market is described as excellent. Growers are keeping an eye out for rot and pests such as thrips, the small winged insects which suck on berry flowers and leaves, squish the varmints.
Although conditions have often been calm and misty around Pukekohe, not much rain fell this week, but that may be about to change. In the meantime, some young brassicas and salad crops have been irrigated. Waikato has had quite a pleasant week with a bit of sunshine, and the grass is growing at a faster rate than many other regions. Calving's coming to an end, and one farmer who has 950 cows says he has had 8 die this season, a lot higher than usual. Artificial insemination starts in the next few weeks for many dairy farmers. Cows are being well fed with fodder beet and calf sheds are being cleaned out. Drenching's underway and chicory crops will soon be planted.
In the Bay of Plenty, gold kiwi fruit are in their full bud stage and the new red kiwi fruit vines are starting to flower. This new hybrid kiwi fruit is popular in Asian countries, particularly China. Milk volumes are a little low due to months of rain. The Ruapehu area's local body elections are getting lots of attention, with several rural people standing for the council. Paddocks around National Park are growing slowly, and everyone's hoping for a burst of warm weather with plenty of sun. Silage is still being fed out, and concern is growing that supplies are running out. Calving is coming to an end, and it's been a tough season for the cows with so much wet weather.
In the Whanganui area too, calves aren't beefing up as fast as farmers would like and milk production in cows is down. A winter of wet and cold weather is being blamed. Cows are also being fed a lot more supplements. Crops are being sown, such as maize and barley, even though the ground is pretty wet underfoot still. A lack of grass suitable for making silage could mean a shortage of feed further down the track. Sales of hoggets and cattle are strong. Gisborne's having what's described as a ripper spring with ideal conditions for lambing. There haven't been many losses when twins are born, which is often not the case. Coastal blocks have finished lambing and inland hill country is starting to lamb about now. Calving's also underway for beef farmers and the price paid for bull meat is sky high, $6.82 a kilo net. It's led to pretty decent prices being paid at stock sales.
In Tikokino, central Hawke's Bay, farmers have joined a field trip to view the property managed by the Regional Farmer of the Year. Hugh Abbas and Sally Terry farm Totara Hills Farm, grazing cattle and sheep and growing cash and forage crops. A few sunny days has meant plenty of overdue shearing while the sheep were dry. It's that time of the year in Wairarapa, docking. With school holidays starting, rural families are rolling up their sleeves for the annual few weeks of whipping off tails and testicles. However, rain is forecast, which is putting a bit of a dampener on plans. The messy long winter means many grass paddocks haven't regrown due to pugging and saturation. They'll be converted into crops this spring.
In Nelson, rain over the week has been spotty. Balance has been reached with grass growth and cattle are being moved around onto new grass on a regular basis. Some beef cattle are about to be drenched and will be heading towards the freezing works soon. Lambing's finished on lowland farms and dairy farmers have just about stopped calving as well. Paddocks are being prepared to plant summer green feed crops now that the soil has dried out a little. The heavy rain on the west coast this week was a welcome freshen up for the region after a fine spell. Farmers are hopeful it'll bring new grass growth after the wet winter stunted the growth rate. Calving's down to the dregs about three quarters of the way through, which brings a bit of rest and reprieve before mating starts up again in November. Lambs are said to be looking absolutely fabulous. They're not having to waste their energy fighting the chill of cold winds.
It's a different story in North Canterbury. Lambs could use a bit more sun and a bit less wind. Farmers are moving into tailing now with lambing season behind them. This week brought good drying out weather and the sun's lifted spirits of stock and people, although pasture growth is slow. Random frosts are also slowing things up. Many are feeding out to cover the difference. Elsewhere in Canterbury, a huge amount of tractor work's been done and irrigation for the season has just started. In Otago, one farmer says it's been one of the best lambing seasons in his 50 years. With only a dusting of snow this season, lamb survival should be strong and hopefully prices stay up. Across the paddock, the phone is already ringing for silage, a month earlier than usual following the dry autumn. Dairy farmers are trying to maximise their production with milk returns high. Calving is also winding up. The only complaint could be from vet clinics. They will have a lack of customers as the good weather hasn't brought as many issues this year. Grass is cranking in Southland with record growth seen in the past 2 weeks. Tractors are moving left and right across the province as they begin baleage 3 weeks earlier than normal. Warm sunny days are keeping smiles on faces with rain coming in through the night. It's a stark contrast to last year, which one contact says was the worst growth season he's seen in his 25 years in Southland.
This is Country Life on RNZ National 101 FM.
Now we're heading into a classroom at St Michael's Church School in Christchurch. Cosmo's there to find out about an educational program that brings farming directly to the kids. He's with teacher Bridget Ladley and her Year 2 students.
So farmer time is developing a relationship between a farmer and a class. And so what we do is every 2 weeks we do a FaceTime call with Pat, and at the beginning of the year Izzy, his wife, was there as well. And so we teach city children what happens on the farm and where things come from. It's opening their eyes to a whole different world. Hi, Pat. I'm just trying to turn the screen round.
Tell me about Pat. Where does he farm?
So he's up in the Hawke's Bay. So I think the idea is that they try and match up classes in one island with the farm from another island. And it's great because it's geography for the children as well as learning what's happening on the farm. Okay, Pat, we can see you at the moment, but my phone is playing up, so you won't be able to see the children because I can't get it to turn round.
I can see a handful of kids.
Oh, excellent. That's good.
Yeah.
Year 2, can you tell Pat what you played with this morning? Call out for him.
Snow!
We had snow at school this morning.
Did you guys make a snowman?
Well, the ones who had jackets this morning were allowed to make a snowman. How are Pepper and Salt getting on?
Yeah, very good. They've got their warm machine to keep them warm, so I'm quite happy about that.
Who are Salt and Pepper?
Could someone put their hand up and tell Cosmo? Toby, can you tell him who Salt and Pepper are?
Salt is a little lamb and Pepper is a calf.
Ah, that makes sense. Thank you.
They're still being bottle-fed, are they?
Yeah. 4 times a day still for the lamb.
How much milk is Salt having now?
She will have 450 up to 150 mils, so she's getting a litre for a day of milk.
So remember, everyone, That's comparing it to my drink bottle, so that's how much she's getting a day. What about Pepper? How much is Pepper getting?
3.5 litres twice. She's getting 7 litres today.
Wow. Big tummy.
Yeah. Both of them are starting to nibble on grass and grains that we're feeding them as well.
Out of your videos that you sent this morning, we probably had the most discussion about the shifting the brake fence.
Yes, fair enough, I thought so.
So do you want to just maybe do a bit more explaining on that one for us?
So the idea is that it's a little plastic wire that's got some metal threads in it, wire threads.
Pat also answered several other interesting questions.
How do you not get electric shot on the fence? What timings does they need to have their food? Can the cows hear very well?
When it's snowing, are the cattle safe?
Did Salt and Pepper ever snuggle each other?
Okay, we're going to take two more questions. We'll have Emily, then Lucy.
Bridget, how did you get onto Farmer's Time?
Because my sister gave my name to Regina, who was organising it for Beef and Lamb Inc., and she got onto me and she asked if I knew any teachers who'd be interested, and I said I'd really like to be involved. They were sort of looking for ones further up A school, but it has worked really well for year twos.
Has Patrick talked about wool?
Yes,
time we watched a video where he was, like, shaving the
butt.
Yeah.
He was shearing the sheep, wasn't he?
And he was doing that. It didn't hurt the sheep, but he told us that he puts a rubber ring or a ring around the tail when they're young to help because it kind of gets in the way. And then there's poo, and then the flies say, yummy, poo, and then they lay the eggs, but when the eggs hatch, they're like worms, and then they dig into the skin, and so it's really helpful. So for 3 hours later, the tail comes off.
That was a good way to explain it, Harriet, because we've had lots of conversations around that.
What are some of the funnier things that the students have asked, Pat?
So one of them was when he was collecting eggs from a neighbour, and one of the children asked if the eggs came from the supermarket, despite the fact there were chickens all around the place and so on. And then when a couple of weeks ago I did ask if Izzy, Pat's wife, had had her baby yet, and one of the children asked me the next day if Izzy was having a baby sheep or a baby cow. And it really hit home to me, the language that we use with them. And so I think, well, it's a great opportunity to be able to teach them something different. So, guys, what do we need to say to Pat?
Thank you!
Thanks for all your good questions.
Yeah, they were good questions too. Well done. Right, we'll talk to you later.
Very good. See you later, Rinto.
Bye!
See ya. Bye.
How would you sum up how important this is for these young students, this program?
I'd say it's absolutely vital, because there is a divide between rural and urban, and I think it's our job to try and close it and bring it together. Children need to know where their food's coming from, and also to see it for themselves rather than just getting it through the media, rather than just getting it in a variety of different ways. Mm. It is that farm-to-table type thing that they see the whole picture. So what are the things that you learnt out of today, Anna?
The electric fence.
What did Pat use this morning to be able to test it? Do you remember? What was it, Harriet?
I don't remember the machine, but you put it under and it tells you how much electric is running through it.
Good, with the voltage of it, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what have we learned about salt and pepper? Toby, what have we learned about them?
Now they drink more milk than they used to.
Well, how many litres was it for Pepper? Do you remember?
2.5.
I think it might have been 3.5 litres, wasn't it? Twice a day?
Yeah.
Because didn't he say it was 7 litres in total? So that would be 7 times this bottle. So you think of your drink bottle, how much you get through a day. How many of your drink bottles would you get through a day?
I would get through 3.5.
Oh, that's a lot. That's 3.5. So that's exactly what Pepper would drink just in the morning, 3.5 of those. Toby, how many of your bottles would you get through?
1.5.
1.5. So that's not quite up to Pepper's standard, is it?
Are you concerned that some students, well, some children don't know where basic food comes from?
I am appalled at times that they don't know where it comes from. And again, because often children aren't involved in actually cooking at home or in that whole thing around the, sitting around the table talking and so on, where do these things come from? And so I'm really grateful that I can bring that into the classroom with a program like that.
Mm. Is this the only classroom that does Farmer Time, or is this happening in all the classrooms?
No, I'm the only one because we're part of the pilot program, except I'd put it out an email to the other teachers last week, and I think the Year 5 class has just joined up, which is great. But I think originally we were the only class in Christchurch that was involved. Mm. But I know that there are now more farmers in classes that want to be involved. So, I mean, I'd just say to any teacher, get involved, because huge learning is coming out of this. Whether it's geography, whether it's anything to do with science, we brought maths into it, language, the whole lot.
Teacher Bridget Ladley there with some of her Year 2 students at St Michael's Church School in Central Christchurch. The farmer on the Farmer Time program is Pat Crawshaw from Hawke's Bay.
It's time now for part one of A Year on the Farm, a 12-part series Cosmo's making with a North Canterbury farmer and YouTuber.
G'day everybody, my name's Alistair Bird. We are here just on the hills and behind Oxford, sheep and beef place here. So going forward, we're going to be giving you an update on the life and what's happening here on our place for the next year. So just monthly updates. And if you want a bit more info, you follow us on YouTube. So Kiwi Farmer on YouTube, got a bit of a following there. So post a video every week.
And Alistair, tell me a bit about the farm here. What size is it and how many stock do you run?
So this place, we're 560 hectares, foothills country, so wee bit of flat, mostly hill country, ranging from rolling to very steep. We sheep and beef, generally breeding, don't tend to finish a lot now. So we've got about 110 cows that we're calving at the moment, plus a few replacements. With our lease block as well, which is just 65 hectares on the other side of Oxford, we're lambing about 1,400.
How long have you been on this land?
So me and my wife and two daughters have been here 8 years. Yeah, originally from Manawatu, came down to the South Island, met my wife down here, and then farmed on the West Coast for a wee bit, and then, got the chance to come back here.
We've come up to one of the high points on your farm, and the view is pretty spectacular. What can we see around us?
Yeah, so we can see right the way across to the Port Hills, Banks Peninsula in the distance, but then at night we can see the lights of Amberley, Rangiora, and then on a clear day you can see the ships out in the sea going towards Lyttelton. If we swing around, we can see obviously Christchurch in the distance there, Rolleston, and then the big milk factory at Darfield. You can see the big white building, and then as we come all the way around, there is Porter's Pass over here, so Torless Range, Mount Hutt ski field in the distance. And then, the main divide. It's pretty stunning up here.
Yes. Now, this is the first episode of 12, and as you've mentioned, I am going to be coming here and chatting with you at the end of each month. Can you give me a bit of a rundown on what happened in September and some of the challenges you faced?
So, September, we have been finishing our lambing down at the lease block, so we early lamb down there from 1st of August. So they finished off there, and then we tailed all the lambs down there. yeah, grass growth has been quite slow down there, just cold, and then with the wet that we had through the winter, very wet winter, so and that stretched into September. And then, yeah, up here on the home farm, we lamb a bit later, so we're in the kind of just getting into lambing up here now. So that's all the pre-lamb vaccinations, drafting. Some early September was pre-lamb shearing. Yeah, that's the sheep side up here, so we're all pretty tidy with that. And then calving up here, start calving 1st of September. So early September or late August, we were vaccinations and set stocking, or putting them behind breaks and feeding cows. So calving is nearly done, another couple of weeks of that.
We are in a paddock now with the cattle that have calved, and the calves are looking great, aren't they?
Yeah, pretty happy with calving this year, the way it's gone. The cows came through the winter really well. There's plenty of feed after last summer. And the calves have come out really well, hit the ground well. Survivability's been great for the calves. They've got plenty of feed in front of them at the moment, the cows do, so the cows should be milking well, feeding their calves well. So we're set up really good.
Mm. What will happen to the calves?
They will stay on their mums until about May, and then they will get weaned and sold off farm. Generally to Ansco we deal with, and then they will end up at probably the five-star feedlot sometime in their lifetime. And then we keep about 30 straight black Angus replacement heifer calves for our own use.
Beyond the cattle, on the steep hill, there are quite a few sheep. Are they waiting to lamb?
Yes, any day they'll be popping out.
And they go right to the ridge, don't they? Right,
yes,
up to the tops.
Yep, so they go right to the skyline, and then there's some over the back as well. So quite high, quite exposed, but they find their little lambing spot and little sheltered spot, yeah.
And over the top of that ridge, which heads towards the Ashley River, you've got some native bush.
Yep, so over the top, yeah, there's about 180-odd hectares in one block out there that we have kind of deemed it's not economic for us to develop, and we like the native out there too. So the plan is at the moment for that to stay as it is and try and gain some value out of that.
Will you get carbon credits for that?
Yeah, so any of the native that's younger than 1989, we can apply to claim carbon credits on. So we're just going through that process at the moment.
Yes. Now, in each episode, we'll cover a farm-related event or activity. So what are we going to talk about today?
Today, it's all about calving and cattle. We're nearly through calving. So we've got 8 mixed-age cows left to go out of 92. And 1 heifer out of 18. So we see the light at the end of the tunnel there, but then also we've got a bull sale to go to this afternoon. So we need another bull because we're going to be mating around 140 odd cattle. So we're going to Timperley Bull Sale, which they farm at View Hill, so just as the crow flies, not that far away from where we farm here. But the bull sale was happening on the runoff just down between here and Cust.
Have you checked out the bulls yet, or are you going to see what they're like when you get there?
No, we haven't seen them. They generally have a bull walk or an open day about a week, 10 days before the actual sale, but we didn't make it to that. So we will go and have a look, but we've got the catalogue, so we've marked a few in the catalogue with their genetic merits, so we can go and have a look at those ones and see what ones we like.
Mm. How much are you prepared to pay?
Ooh. we've probably spent it, yeah, we've set a limit of about $3,500 at this stage for a yearling bull. So we bought one last year for about that same money from the same place, and he's done really well, quite happy with him, so that's why we're going to go back.
We have come down the hill and we've driven into a paddock where, Alistair, you've got your lovely big bulls.
Yeah, so the driveway paddock at home, here we call the bull paddock. Apparently it's always housed the bulls, so from the previous owners as well. So, yeah, we've got four bulls in here, and just looking at one that we bought last year at the Timperleys bull sale. So he's done quite well. He's a nice-looking bull.
What's so special about these bulls?
We like the temperament, and that flows through to the calves. Like, our calves are really quite quiet, the way we handle them. Don't use dogs on them. Yeah, really quiet in the yards, so you don't fear for your life, essentially, when you're handling them. So temperament's a big one. So we're standing 5 metres away from these bulls, and they're just happily grazing. So it's a big thing, especially with kids around as well.
Oh. And they're big boys. How heavy are they?
So the fella in the back over here, he's probably 5 years old. He'd be close to 1,000 kilos.
Gosh.
But these ones here would be 800.
And the bull that you hope to purchase at the on-farm bull sale, what sort of size and weight is that likely to be?
Generally, they're 550, maybe pushing 600 kilos as a yearling.
They are very relaxed, aren't they?
Yeah.
How many cattle can one of these bulls go over in a season?
Ratio is normally about one bull to 40 or 50 cows. So we need four bulls because we have our first calvers, so cattle that haven't calved before, and then second calvers will be in a different mob as well. So that's, they've had their one calf and they're getting in calf again for the second time. Mm. And then two bulls will go out with the mixed age cows, the older cows.
The big bull is coming right up to us, and he's got a huge head, isn't he?
he's a big fella, yep.
How long will he be, you know, working on the farm for?
This coming mating will probably be his last. So he would have had three matings. So he came from up near Culverton. There's two bulls from a stud up there.
Great. Okay, well, I will catch up with you down at the bull sale, and hopefully you'll have some luck with your bidding.
Yeah, yep. So we'll go and try our luck down there. And if you guys want to see a bit more on how we got on down there, there'll be a video on our YouTube channel. So, Kiwi Farmer.
Lot 21. I really like this bull out there. Lovely clean shoulder bull, moderate frame, low birth, positive ribbon run, very good scrotals on it. Lot to like about this guy. I have two again. 2,000 at $2,000 at 2,000, 2,500 online at 2,500 $5, at 2,500 $5, at 5, at 5, at 2,500 $5, at 2,525 at 2,500. 2,5. I'll take the line ride.
Yes.
2. I'll take over the proxy, sorry.
How did it go?
Good, thank you. Yeah, I managed to get one, so probably paid a little bit more, but talked it through with Jenna, my wife, and yeah, we came to a conclusion that it was worth paying a wee bit more for bulls that would suit our purpose, so still within our price range, adjusted price range, yeah. Yeah.
So what did you end up paying?
$5,000, but compared to a two-year-old bull, you know, we pay double that for our last purchase. So, pretty happy. It ticks a lot of the boxes.
What was it about that bull that you liked in particular?
So, good growth. Yeah, has good growth right the way through. Low birth weight, so easy calving. So, you get a calf onto the ground and then it'll grow.
Yes.
As long as you feed it right. So, yeah, now we've just got to feed them.
And did you have a bit of a bidding battle for that bull?
Yeah, there was another guy or a couple of guys that wanted that bull, so it's always nice to come away with one within your budget, yeah, but you just never know quite how the day's going to turn out until you actually get here, so yeah, they'll deliver it sometime in the next week or 10 days.
And then it will go out with the other bulls?
Yeah, we'll go out with the other bulls and get used to them, and then, yeah, in November it'll have a job in front of them.
Excellent, well, good luck with the bull, and I look forward to catching up with you at the end of October to find out how things are going.
Yep, no, look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Alistair Bird there. And as Cosmo mentioned, episode 2 of A Year on the Farm will go to air in about 4 weeks' time. And you can find a link to Alistair's bull sale YouTube video on the RNZ Country Life webpage.
It's been so wet this winter, it's been tricky getting out and about to record stories for Country Life. The day I'm due to meet Mere Whanga on the Mahia Peninsula, the weather's so bad we can't make it out to her ancestral land. But she has a cosy cottage on the beachfront to retreat to and a warm fire going. So that's where we're heading.
Kia ora, Sally.
Kia ora, Mere. Thank you. Beautiful house, Mere.
It is gorgeous. I mean, I was looking for a villa, and I was really more concerned about my studio than anything else. The kind of the rest of the house came with it, almost. So this is where I do.
This is where you do your work. This is your studio. Looks like many people have walked on this floor.
Yes.
It's got splatters of paint.
Yes, and that's why I didn't polish it or anything, because I thought, no.
Mere is an historian, writer and illustrator of Ngāti Rongomai Wahine and Ngāti Kahununu descent. And she's also kaitiaki, or guardian, along with her children, of Taiporutu, on the eastern side of the peninsula. 21 generations have been linked to that land, and she's documenting its fascinating story in a book after being awarded Creative New Zealand's prestigious Michael King Writers' Fellowship. Mere's son Clem puts another log on the fire, and I settle in to hear more.
Our farm, Taiporutu, is just under 100 hectares. It's marginal farming land. It was never going to make a living for us as a family. We go back 21 generations to when the Takitimu arrived. So we are descendants of those who came on the Takitimu. But there were people here already before that, at least four generations before the Takitimu arrived. My children have been raised to consider this their homeland. They have all the mātauranga that goes with being ahikaro, having lived on the land, our ancestors having occupied it for those 21 generations. So they know the boundaries, they know the waters, they know the pass sites, they know, and there's more than one, they know where the kāinga were, where the gardens were, they know where to get kai, they know the reefs, they know the fishing grounds. So all of what would have been considered traditional knowledge, my children have been raised with, because that was really important to us. It's not enough just to occupy the land. You need to know how you came to be able to occupy that land. And you need to know the land so that you can look after it.
Just being able to go and sit down on the par sites and have it explained to us how they used to live and where they used to live, right through to being involved with some of the burial grounds down there and having to rebury some of the bones that appear out on the beach. Mum ran the farm during the week and Dad worked off the farm all week and would come home and work on the farm during the weekend, and that was, you know, is how we got through the 80s crash. And that's how it's continued as we grow as adults, is that we all have our own outside incomes and we don't rely on Taiporutu. It takes a lot of pressure off that, and we're able to keep it as home.
We also have healing springs on our land, which are still being used occasionally. Some years ago, my second daughter, Desna, she started looking at our land, you know, for the historical taonga that it is. And she had the half of the healing springs fenced off. So that was the beginning. And then a few years ago, I secured funding for erosion control project around our part of the stream, which was 7 hectares. And Clem came home. He actually suggested we plant the whole farm in trees. And I sort of went, no, I still need some pasture. I would, you know.
Because it was farming sheep and beef?
Yes.
Just prior?
Yeah, just prior. And it wasn't doing the land any good. So we settled on 70 hectares. And we went to the 1BT.
That's the 1 billion trees.
Sorry, yes, yeah. 1 billion trees, yeah. And we developed a plan We did seriously look at just doing Manuka, and then we looked at it and thought, no, actually that would be replacing one sort of monoculture, being grass, with another. And we thought about all that ancestral connection, and we decided to do a mixed, I think they called it mixed indigenous planting. I applied for funding, we got it. Clem and I developed a planting plan for what would go where, using all the traditional concepts that our ancestors had about our land and trees and how they were used. And we have some outstanding examples of ancestral use. We have ancestral perfume and cosmetic plantations.
For years, Mere had driven past the ancient titoke trees on Taiporutu and not given much thought to the way they grew in a rigid pattern.
Now, with titoke, that was the most highly prized cosmetic oil for our ancestors, and normally they only fruit, have a decent crop every 4 years. We looked at ours, realised, oh, these are planted in a line, this is not natural, and they crop every year. And so it was obvious, A, being planted in a line, B, that they were selected by our ancestors for their characteristic.
And when Mere and her family dug further, yet more evidence came to light about the way her ancestors, her tipuna, used the trees.
First thing was an image drawn by somebody on Captain Cook's ship on the Endeavour in 1769, October 1769. And it was looking at the landscape from Table Cape to Waikawa, to Portland Island. It was actually my daughter, Desna, who pointed out that right in the middle where the fold of the illustration was our pass site. And she had to point it out to me because I thought, oh, it is too. So then I looked up the diaries. So a chapter of my book is dedicated to Captain Cook's diaries and everything he says about the Mahia and down to the Hawke's Bay. And he mentioned a waka going out. And so we worked it out from kind of the coordinates and the depth finding and everything that he had in his diary, that he was anchored off Taipurutu. And the waka that went out had, I think, three men and two women. But the thing that he mentioned was how well-dressed the men were and that they were wearing perfume sachets, which were made with titoki oil. So we thought, oh. So, and then looking at our trees and how many hundreds of years old they probably are, those were probably the trees that produced the titoki oil that was round those men's neck as they went out to meet Captain Cook. So that was one of the really lovely discoveries in the research.
And other discoveries followed.
Titoki oil itself doesn't have a scent, but it holds scent. So we then looked, Clem and I looked through our existing coastal forest, our remnant coastal forest, and sure enough, there are plantations, groves here and there, of various and very old perfume trees. Kohuhu is one. We have lots of groves of kohekohe, which also has very high use as a rongoā plant. There's a very old tarata tree down there. Clem found a very old hekitara tree near one of our kohekohe groves. So,
and all possibly used for fragrances.
Yes, well, the fact that, you know, we've got, on the one hand, the titoki plantation, then not very far away you've got these other very mature trees that were very necessary for perfumes. So, amazing. Yeah, it is amazing.
Mere, are you going to do something with the titoki berries, maybe to make the perfume again?
Yes. We've tried pressing the ends for the first time, and I've got a friend who's a rongoā practitioner, and she came over and we celebrated the first pressing of our titoki oil.
Do you know what some of those fragrances were like? Are there any records about that?
We haven't found any made, but, you know, things like tarata, lemonwood. You just have to crush the leaf, and it's very fragrant. Some of the, what were those berries? Kuhuhu?
Yep, and just the other things that we've been finding, like the white rata.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's just amazing smells that come out of even just manuka at different times of the year. The white rata was a real surprise.
Yeah, we've got a lot of white rata on our farm.
And I think it's quite important to bring some of those fragrances back.
So when will we see Tai Porutu as a fragrance on the shelves?
hopefully within the next 5 to 10 years. And it's not just being able to get that, but it's able to harvest it sustainably and harvest it commercially. So being able to grow those crops, some of our trees take 50 years to grow before they start flowering and fruiting. So it may just be that there's small little bits come out here and there.
How many more tetoki did you plant?
About 500.
Extending that old plantation?
Putting it in more accessible places. And then so hopefully at some stage we may be able to graft some trees off those ancient things so that we can grow and produce more readily and early than what a normal tetoki tree would actually fruit.
And what about those fragrance trees? Have you extended those plantings?
Yes, so we've got a good group of trees all around the farm and just identifying where they are and mapping that out.
We've actually been living on the farm. It's been 40-odd years since we built the house there. A lot of that time was consumed with fencing and building yards and finding water and stock farming. So it's only now that we come back with our own other incomes in the farm's set up, and now we can look at this. And also, I've done academic study to PhD level. I'm a professional historian. I did our treaty claims research, our Takutai Moina research. So it's bringing all those skills finally to deciding what we were going to do. And when 1 Billion Trees Fund came up, that's the first time in 40 years that we got to indulge ourselves and plant natives everywhere. It was wonderful.
Our trees arrived 2 years ago, and yeah, they're absolutely flourishing. They love it there. They've even in the last sort of 6 to 12 months, they've doubled in size, the majority of them, and yeah, they look like they're really enjoying the environment there. So that's really great to see.
And how many species?
Approximately 20 to 30 different species spread over 70,000 trees. So the vast majority of that's manuka because it's such a great nursing crop. Just a good spread of trees for different reasons, whether they be bees or birds or fragrances or if they work in as to hold the soil together. It's a bit of a passion, really, and it's great to see that it's coming together and flourishing. Even with outside incomes, it's something that us as a whānau wouldn't have been able to do without that injection of capital cost from the councils or the government.
I was given some of the land at Tai Porutu by my aunts, and that was the only thing they asked of me. They said, please keep the name. And they gave me the history of it. They said, this name came on the Wakataki Timu. This name came from Hawaiki. And I said, well, of course, aunt.
What does it mean, Tai Porutu?
Tai Porutu, my dad explained it this way. Tai meaning the sea, Porutu, the booming sound it makes when it hits the rocks. You only hear that when there's a big swell coming in from the southeast. You can hear it particularly at night. It kind of booms, it comes right up the valley to the house. It's quite distinctive.
Taipurutu's treasures, its taonga, will be documented in Mere's upcoming book. She says the Māori land court records from the late 1800s were a great source of information.
I went there to see how our people lived with the land, what they ate, where they were. For instance, one of the things, karaka tree. You know, a lot of people will say, oh, you can't have a karaka tree, it's poisonous. Actually, no, it was one of the most highly valued foods. The nut, when it was dried, was full of protein, was really great. Those who came on the Takitimu, they brought it with them. There was one that was such a good producer, it fed four families.
But it was also a case of checking the land beneath their feet.
How much time did you spend fossicking?
Oh, look, we didn't have to look for it too hard because, of course, with the sheep and the cattle, the banks erode. And so you're walking along a sheep track and there's all these shells in front of you. And then you think, oh, yes, there's the midden there. And Bob was mainly doing the fencing and I was helping. He said, to see what tipuna's rubbish tip. And there was a big midden. And we went and had a look, and we found kumara pits. And that wasn't so much a pass site as a kāinga site. It was an occupation site. And I took Clem took me and his daughter on a trip round there last year, son. Mm. And we found the remnant walls of a house. You know, they were yay high in a nice neat corner. And then looked down and thought, oh, of course.
There's evidence all over the farm and in different places. It's quite phenomenal once you actually start looking for it and you're not just, walking around the land, you're actually looking for these things, how much of it you find.
And how does that influence you in the further development of the land?
I guess just ensuring that those sites, that we look after them really well and that they're not lost so that our children can take their children to it.
For people of Rongomai Wahine descent, Rongomai Wahine Kahungunu descent, it's really important. A lot of our people are so dissociated from their land and from their history and from their reo that what we've done, what we're putting into practice, what I'm going to put in the book, will be of great interest to them. But also a lot of non-Māori are really, really keen to know this stuff, the mātauranga. And I can say, look, I've given you 21 generations worth of mātauranga. We've looked at things differently, and here's what I've found. A lot of people who are really keen on preserving our native bush think that means locking it up because it's nice to look at. But we didn't. We took a completely different approach. We looked for how our ancestors lived with that land. Obviously the Te Toki plantation is a shining example of cosmetics, and that also says something about a society, that cosmetics can be really important. So they've gone well past survival and they're into a thriving society, where they want hair oil and they want perfumes and that sort of thing. So how did they live with the land, and so that it keeps on living? It's not just locking it up and not doing anything with it ever after. We use kaitiakitanga a lot, this whole guardianship ethic, but we need to remember that we humans are part of that. It's not just to preserve the trees. It's not just to preserve the birds, or the bees, or the insects, or the freshwater fish. We have to be preserved too. We have to be able to eat and use things for building and weaving and everything.
Would you say that's part of the aim of your book?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's trying to encourage a different perspective. That, yes, our biodiversity is hugely, hugely important. Our ecologies, we are rebuilding an ecology on Taipōrutu, but we are part of it too.
Mm-hmm. Mere Whanga. You also heard from her son, Clem Sholem Whanga. Mere expects her book, 21 Generations of Tai Porutu, to be ready in the first half of next year. It's being published by Rainbird Books. Go to our webpage for photos of all our stories today, and you can also listen there to plenty more from Country Life over the years. The online archive starts from about 2008, although we go back exactly a quarter of a century. A change of time to note, starting from next week, will be broadcast at the new time of 7 o'clock during nights, just after the news. But it's still the same time on Saturday morning. Thanks for joining us. Ka kite.
Bye now.